Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we visit a knife thrower, talk with local musician Jay Bennett about his life with the band Wilco and his new solo album, and we get the truth behind rock and roll's most famous myths and legends. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. The art of knife throwing is a classic sideshow act, balancing skill and risk in a performance that is truly death-defying. Although knife throwing hit its heyday around the turn of the last century with Wild West shows, it still thrives today thanks to both skilled throwers and thrill-seekers who place themselves on the target. Craig Lamult has this profile of a modern-day thrower.
David Adamovich was 50 years old before he threw his first knife. He'd already been a professor of exercise physiology, an executive at an emergency response company, an ordained minister, and a pool hall owner, but he found his real calling when a friend introduced him to the sport of throwing knives at targets. He found he had a natural skill for it, and within a short time he was winning national contests. Soon he moved on to the next level. Only the most accurate and confident knife throwers aim to miss. He asked a business colleague to be a target.
I said, look, I need somebody to practice throwing some knives around. And he said, I'd love to try it. And he came, and he stood at the board, and I was so nervous, and he didn't know it. And it was my first time that I was throwing around someone. And after I did that first set around him, he stepped away, and he said, that was really very exciting. Can we do it again? It was more fun than when I had my nipples pierced.
Adamovich loved it too, although he might have phrased it differently. He developed an act and began to perform. He doesn't look like your typical sideshow performer. With tortoiseshell glasses and a conservative haircut, he looks more like an economist than a knife thrower. But on stage, he's decked out in a flamboyant tux and matching red cummerbund and tie. His wife gave him the name that would become famous across the knife-throwing world.
She just decided to call me the Great Throwdini one day, and that was it. It stuck. But my friends call me Thro.
The Great Throwdini has performed in Coney Island, in Russia, headlined an off-Broadway show, and picked football winners on ESPN by throwing knives at a team names on a spinning wheel. He's even been on Letterman.
It's the Great Throwdini and his assistant, Ula. And keep throwing those knives! We'll be right back.
The Great Throwdini lives in a large house in Freeport, Long Island. He still owns a pool hall and performs a few weddings a week, so he's doing okay for himself. In his attic is Throwdini's equivalent of the Bat Cave, an escape from the world where he can play with his dangerous toys. At one end of the long room is a wooden target board, and resting on a coffee table is a pile of 14-inch knives.
Well, those are
sorry.
Knives. You see, they're real.
Whoops, yeah, they are real. It's dangerous here in Throwdini Central, isn't it?
Yes.
Along one wall, plaques, certificates, and photos tell the history of his knife-throwing achievements.
Here's three of my six world record certificates. This one is for the double ladder of death I performed with Harry Monroe.
The double ladder of death.
This is knife thrower Harry Monroe, who early on was something of a mentor when Throwdini was first starting out. The two of them teamed up to set a new world record with the double ladder of death stunt.
The fastest, the most daring, the most death-defying knife throwing stunt ever performed before a live audience.
The girl stands in the middle of the board, and the two knife throwers stand about 7 or 8 feet from the board.
Now, the way that we've performed this is I align myself on the left-hand side of the girl. The great Throwdini aligns himself on the right-hand side of the girl.
And then we threw 16 knives in 6.5 seconds as they crisscross in the air on the opposite side of her body. So it's a pretty dangerous stunt.
So just how dangerous is knife throwing, really? Throwdini says he's never hit anybody, but he admits to the occasional scratch from a knife bouncing off the board. During one performance, he had a knife land a lot closer than he meant to, and he says it really shook him up. I asked what it's like to have someone's life in your hands like that.
Well, I try not to think of it that way, but it's on my mind 24/7 at the same time. It's just something you're always aware of, you're always thinking about, but when it comes time to do the show, all fears move to the side. You get up and you do your business and you do it the best you can.
It's a tough time to be a knife thrower. With so many businesses paranoid about liability, the fact that these stunts are legitimately dangerous presents a kind of a knife thrower's paradox. The whole appeal of the act is the danger, but it can make it tough to get gigs. He's had scheduled performances canceled at the last minute by nervous venues. But the knife thrower's biggest challenge may not be getting gigs or even throwing the knives. It's finding a target, someone who will stand there and let you throw knives around her.
It's very difficult. It takes a special kind of girl to stand there and on the one hand look very feminine and very fragile and very delicate, and at the same time be fearless and make the audience be totally confused how this damsel in distress can also be the brave girl who stands there while the knives are being thrown all around her.
Throdini says it's always a girl. The audience just connects better when it's a beautiful woman having knives thrown around her. He didn't get too into the psychosexual reasons why, it just definitely works better. In the old days of the impalement arts, as those in the biz call it, the knife throwers were usually married to their target girls. But Adamovich was married for more than 20 years before he became the great Throdini, and his wife wasn't interested in the role.
It's the primary issue, it's the number one concern of anyone who's not married to the girl. You have to find a girl who's basically has total availability in the strangest times and who hopefully doesn't have a jealous boyfriend.
It turns out that jealous boyfriends are no small issue. Part of the problem is the flirtation between thrower and target that's a natural part of the act. But Throdini also says that there's a level of closeness and trust that develops that can be difficult for boyfriends to handle, and he's had problems with jealous young men in the past. But of all the potential problems, the inherent danger of the job, the advice of those who think the idea is nuts, the discomfort of the sexual metaphor, it turns out the biggest obstacle to finding a good target girl is the whims of the girl's schedules. The job has some odd hours and requires a lot of availability. Throdini's most recent target girl is busy getting a master's degree, and he's been actively looking for a replacement. The search has been tough, but he's just stumbled into a bit of luck.
Just so happens today, two girls came to do an article about me for a magazine, and one of the girls, as soon as she saw the knives, and I jokingly said, "How would you like to be my assistant?" She said, "Wow, that sounds great. I'd love to do it."
He turned to us and asked if we would be, either one of us would be interested in being a target girl, not for, you know, any long period of time, but just for that day for demonstration. And I said, "Sure." And so he put me up there, and I think he threw about six knives on either side of me.
I put her up to the board. I threw a few knives around her, and she was perfect. She loved it.
And then he just kind of looked at me and asked maybe if I would be interested in doing this a couple of times or a few times. I said, sure.
Amy Cantwell is everything the great Throdini is looking for. She's young and attractive, she has a background in theater, no jealous boyfriend, and she seems completely unfazed by the thought of knives whizzing by her.
I was kind of curious as to what it would be like to be a target, definitely. I've always kind of been interested in it. I'm always just wondering what it would be like.
You've actually, in the past, had the thought, you know, I'd like to be a target girl for a knife thrower.
Yeah, not as a career, but yeah, I thought it might be interesting to try once or twice.
As an art therapy teacher and bartender, Amy gets a mixed reaction when she tells people about her latest career move. Some initially think a target girl is a spokeswoman for the store Target. And most, including her mother, make the assumption that knife throwing isn't actually real. Most people seem to think that knife throwing is a kind of illusion, like magic, and that somehow the throwers are just making it look like they're throwing the knives, but they're actually popping out of a trick board. But I can now tell you, without a doubt, that they are not.
How about getting you up the board and I'll throw a few around you?
Really?
Why not?
I follow the great Throdini out to the back of his house, where a deck looks out over Freeport's wood-cleft canal. In one corner of the deck is a small chapel, complete with a few rows of pews where he performs weddings. Opposite the altar is a target board and the spinning wheel of death. But before I add target guy to my resume, I make him give me a demonstration.
I could either throw half spin from the blade, which means I grab it by the pointy end, stand about 7 feet from the board, and it makes a half spin and sticks. Or I could throw from the handle and step out to about 12 feet. If the distance is right, it'll stick. If the distance is not right, it'll flop to the ground. I was the right distance. It stuck. It's going through the air at about 30 miles an hour, and it's rotating like a pinwheel. Like that. So if you want to stand in there, I'll just throw a few around you, and you can hold the mic about like that and hold this arm up over your head and go this way just a little bit. No, just stand. Face me.
Yep.
So that I want room over there. Okay.
Okay, I've lifted my left arm.
I'm going to throw about four or five on each side of you, all right?
Okay.
Don't move.
Oh, my God.
Don't move.
Jesus. Holy. God.
That's it. You got it.
Oh, there are knives on both sides of me. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 on my left, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on my right. And there's about, what would you, how many inches would you say on either side of me are these knives?
About 4 inches.
I'm target guy extraordinaire, Craig LaMolt.
You got the message.
That, yeah, okay. Well, that was, thank you for that.
My pleasure.
This is Sidetrack. Video games have come a long way from the days of Pong. Today, video games are a multi-billion dollar a year industry. They are also becoming the subject of academic research. In fact, the University of Illinois Library has recently started its own video game collection. I recently went to the undergraduate library on the U of I campus where the collection is held to see what games they had and what they're doing with them.
My name is David Ward. I'm the head of information services for the undergraduate library. Among the many things I do is collection development for a lot of the arts and humanities type collections we have, as well as the popular culture collections we have.
So tell me about this recent addition to the library, video games.
Okay. This started back in spring of this year, 2006, and it was an initiative on many levels. Something that we'd been thinking about doing here at the undergrad as we started collecting graphic novels a few years back. And we're just sort of always looking at new medium, new things, especially that the younger students, the undergraduate students, are interested in. This is also something that at the higher levels of the library they're looking at strategically, because video games are not something that research libraries have started to collect systematically. But they are something that is gaining a lot of interest in education and in the literature for use in academia, use in schools as a teaching tool, things like that. So we started in spring with a small collection and sort of been growing from there.
You said that these have been used as a teaching tool. Do you know any examples of how and why something like Dance Dance Revolution or Mario Party 7, mm-hmm. or any other game, I guess, would be used in a educational context?
Sure. Dance Dance Revolution is actually a really good example. It's been used in a lot of high schools and grade schools as something for physical education, something that kids will be interested in.
Okay. Tell me what's in this closet.
Sure. Maybe I'll summarize sort of in total what we have. We started with collecting more popular games for current platforms like PlayStation 2, Xbox 360, Nintendo GameCube, things like that. And then we also have started getting into building an archive of vintage games. By vintage, I mean things from particularly the 90s, but also some stuff from the 80s, from the early era of video games. So in this cabinet here, we have some things from earlier Sega Genesis machines, Nintendo and Super Nintendo machines. We also have a collection of Atari 2600 games that we're getting ready right now as well. And there's also a library-wide, we're involved right now in a grant. The Library of Congress is looking at preserving artifacts of popular culture, and they've specifically indicated video games as being something they want to look at preserving. So we're trying to get involved with the grant to find ways to archive and preserve these. Other thing we have up here, we have some game carts. Use these on our gaming nights.
Gaming nights.
Gaming nights. We've had two of those so far. One in spring, and then we just held one a couple weeks ago. Basically, these are a chance to advertise the collection and also to get a lot of student input and feedback on what we're doing and how things are working out with the collection.
Well, describe what we have up here.
Sure. On the gaming cards, we basically have televisions hooked up to various consoles that we have. So we have Xbox 360, Xbox let's see, Nintendo GameCube, PlayStation 2. A little further down back in this area, we also have some of the vintage game things hooked up. So for the gaming night, we hooked up some of the old, the Super Nintendo system was actually pretty popular. A lot of people wanted to play the original Super Mario Brothers and Atari 2600 and some of the other things. These are also tools that we see for future instructional use, as well as just things to bring out at the gaming night where instructors can be able to show and demonstrate games to classes and talk about in specific aspects of them.
Now, you talked about the Library of Congress had a grant for preserving popular culture.
They have, they actually have a project for preserving digital culture. It's called NDIIP, N-D-I-I-P. I can't think of what it stands for right now. But as part of that, they're talking about preserving, you know, aspects of popular culture. There's a particular grant that's been, there's people from the University of Illinois, from the library, from the library school. It's also people from Stanford. And I believe Maryland is the other institution. And the piece that we wrote is talking about archiving electronic texts as well as video games, finding ways to preserve and archive video games.
It leads to an interesting question of the storage mm-hmm. of the games. And you know, these aren't books. You just can't put them on a shelf. They're a little bit different in size and scope.
Yeah, and a lot of the question, it's actually pretty difficult as we were... We did a lot of conference calls to try to figure out the best ways to do it. There's a question of, do you preserve just the game as a physical piece, as an artifact, and try to keep a machine around that will hopefully play it, you know, like maybe like a Betamax would be an example right now. But as we found out, we have a video collection here. The Betamax machines eventually all fall apart and nobody makes them anymore. So you have to find some way to reformat and make the content accessible again. And there's also the question of not just the game itself, but the game playing experience, which particularly for researchers and people who want to look back on the cultural aspects of the video games and what they say about the culture of the time that they were created. You need to somehow be able to get back at that game playing experience. And so that's one of the things, the difficult issues that the grant hopes to look at if it's successful. Usually about half the collection or more is checked out at any one time. So you can see we have all the different Xbox 360, PlayStation 2.
At some point, there was a threshold between video games as entertainment mm-hmm. and then video games as objects of research.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true, and it's definitely something, I think, as video games have increased in complexity, people are discovering, well, not necessarily discovering, but they're really taking an interest in the types of learnings that occur in video games. And really looking at, you know, when you see people normally think of video games, they think of their kids sitting alone in a room for hours playing the game. That's actually not a good model right now because a lot of the games are now more social. You think of things like World of Warcraft where you have thousands of people, tens of thousands of people playing at the same time, engaging in new kinds of communities. But also the tasks that they're asked to do in the video games, it's a lot more complex than something like Pac-Man where you walk around and you eat dots. You have something where you have to... a game like World of Warcraft, you have to coordinate, use team building and leadership and other techniques to coordinate a group of people. You have to formulate a task, to accomplish a lot of the goals of the games. There's a lot more higher end things going on in order to be successful in the games. And so I think when we're bringing that back into an academic environment, just looking at all the things that people are willing to invest their time in to accomplish much higher end tasks, and then how can that be utilized to also teach different types of content.
Now, you mentioned it here, and you talked about it earlier, about capturing the not just the game itself, but the game-playing experience. How do you quantify that experience? You know, how do you categorize that sort of experience and make that available?
That is a darn good question. There's a lot of, that's one of the things that they're looking at with it. Is it something that you can describe? Is it something that you hook up a game and digitally record an hour's worth of gameplay or snapshots of gameplay for longer games over a period of weeks? And does that summarize the gameplay? That's one of the issues that they really need to figure out in this grant and to help figure out those how we can archive and preserve these.
Are you a big gamer?
I'm a medium gamer.
What's your game of choice?
I tend to play a lot of sports games with my friends. I just don't have the time to invest in something like the longer games like World of Warcraft, although they certainly look fun.
Well, if someone is interested about checking out the video game collection here at the library or learning more about the research of video games, where can you lead them to?
They can just come to the undergraduate library. We also have a website where we're trying to capture all the activities that are going on campus. It's www.library.uiuc.edu/gaming. And we mention a lot of things. There's a gaming listserv that's run by gaming researchers on campus where they have periodic meetings and they kind of talk about the different types of gaming research that are going on, some of the classroom use, things like that. We have some links up to different classes, different things that are in the collection, and sort of general news about gaming activities on campus.
That was David Ward from the U of I Library talking about their new video game collection. Listening to Sidetrack. Ever get a catalog and take a good look at all those pictures of bedding sets? Have you ever wondered who ironed up those sheets and folded them so they look so absolutely perfect? That person is called a bed stylist. They get paid just to make all the beds in the catalog look beautiful. And there are reasons why those beds look so much better than when you make your bed at home. When she's not producing radio features, Sue Mell works as a freelance bed stylist. She shares some of her secrets on making the perfect bed.
I'm going to start with ironing the dust ruffle or the bed skirt. This is a tailored bed skirt. Basically, I'm just going to prep as much as I'm going to see. So kind of what you see in the picture looks beautiful, and if you were to walk 1 foot over, everything is like a big pile of wrinkly mess, or maybe there's clamps or pins or bricks sitting on it to weight stuff down, all different kinds of stuff. I do beds, I do drapes, I do stacks of towels, upholstered couches, anything that's soft and has fabric on it, that's my territory. I've got one side of the bed skirt lying on the box spring, and now I'm going to take some T-pins to just keep the bed skirt in place when we slide the mattress back on top. My biggest thing is I almost always would go for more perfection than they would. Usually they're like, that looks great, let's shoot it. And I'm like, oh, no, there's still something, can I just? And they're like, no, get out, we're shooting. So sometimes you are sort of like the unwanted guest. Tell people that you're a bed stylist, and everybody thinks it's kind of like a funny, weird thing, but nobody really knows what that means or what it is. It's sort of like playing house or something, you know, you're pretending to make this fabulous bed that no one's going to sleep in. It's physically demanding. Getting stuff prepped and putting it on the bed and stretching the sheet and moving furniture around. It's a lot of physical work. At the end of the day, I'm pretty tired. The next thing is the duvet. I'm going to iron out the duvet, and then I'm going to stuff it with either one or two comforters. The duvet is the most labor-intensive part. Stuffing it and then trying to make a turn back that looks nice and interesting and flowing and beautiful, or tailored and neat if that's the look that you're going for. Usually the first thing people say is, oh, can you bounce a quarter off the bed that you make? And I'm like, no, because I'm not making an army cot. And people always ask me if I make my own bed, which I never do. I'm a big slob at home. So I just lost my pins. Oh, they're here. So I have a great big sheet of fiberfill, and I'm going to cut it up, and I'm going to wrap up the pillow to make it even fatter than what it is so that it really fills out the case. It's a puzzle sometimes to figure out how to fit all the pillows in. The thing that I like best about doing beds is that you take this pile of wrinkled, rumpled up sheets and pillowcases, and you make everything look perfect and beautiful.
That was Sue Mell, freelance radio producer and professional bed stylist. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. In the world of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, there's a fine line between truth and urban legend. Sorting fact from fiction is Gavin Edwards, former columnist for Rolling Stone magazine. He's the author of a new book titled, Is Tiny Dancer Really Elton's Little John? Music's Most Enduring Mysteries, Myths, and Rumors Revealed. It's published by Three Rivers Press. I talked to Edwards recently and asked him what is the number one rock myth and which question he gets asked most often.
I'd say that one is the one and the same. And the one I get asked over and over, people want to know, did the Ohio Players stab a woman while they were recording Love Roller Coaster? Just sort of, it astonished me, like, the frequency with which I got this letter, but it's one of those things with rock myths, like, you hear them when you're 12, and they just, like, latch on your brain, and you can't let go. So it's, I actually answered that. The book, Is Tiny Dancer Really Elton's Little John, started as a collection of columns in Rolling Stone magazine. And the very first column, I answered it. I got one of the Ohio Players on the phone, and, he, of course, had heard the story himself over and over. And he said, we've never been arrested. We've never been incarcerated. He said, some of us have been handcuffed. We've had some wild times, but that's different.
And so the answer is?
The answer is no, of course not. For a variety of, aside from the fact that the Ohio Players are not homicidal maniacs, if you killed a woman in the studio and it just happened to be on tape, wouldn't you erase the tape instead of releasing it?
I would think, reading your book and knowing about music urban myths, I would have thought the Paul McCartney, Paul is Dead urban legend, or... not really an urban legend, but the Carly Simon, You're So Vain.
Right.
Figuring out who's
the... Paul is Dead, I think, had as big a hold on people as anything in its time, where people were really obsessed with it, especially when you find out you can sort of play Revolution Number 9 backwards and it sounds like Turn Me On Dead Man. But at this point, it's mostly people goofing around with it. Sort of no one thinks Paul is actually dead, although there are websites where people sort of have fun, like, looking for further clues in, like, Paul McCartney's solo albums. But, they're basically just goofing around at this point. So it's more just kind of like an interesting bit of history that, sort of like, wow, was there really, like, a year when people thought that? And, like, what were the clues that made them think that? Because it all seems so remote now. You're So Vain is absolutely, like, one of those ongoing questions. Carly is smart enough to know that, the mystery is part of what piques people, which is why she's, dropped hints at various points, but, doesn't blurt out the secret. But her current husband was a little more loose-lipped than her, which is why I was able to answer the question in the book, because there's lots of people it's been connected to, is it Warren Beatty, who's obviously vain enough for it to be possible? Is it Mick Jagger, who sang backing vocals on it? Is it James Taylor, who she's married to? And according to her husband, it's none of these people. It's just, a guy she went out with before she was famous. But, Carly comes from money. Her father was the Simon and Simon & Schuster publishers. So she sort of traveled in a jet-set crowd, and she had a jet-setter boyfriend who was apparently that vain.
And as the old saying goes, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Right. And if she tells people this, well, hey, it's just this guy, it's nobody special, people go, oh, okay. If they think, but it might be Warren Beatty, it's much more titillating.
Which band or person do you think has the most rock and roll urban legend attached to them?
Well, I think there's... probably the most curiosity about various aspects of the Beatles story, just because they're kind of like the version of a rock band, that, you know, sort of, there were so many different things they did, and they were so central to the culture that there's so many different that people are interested in sort of even like the smallest details of the studio, like, oh, hey, did you know that Ringo got the distinctive drum sound by putting like the eight-armed sweater from the Beatles photo shoot in his bass drum, and that was like why it sounded the way it did. But I think the band that sort of defined like sort of the debauchery rock myth was Led Zeppelin. There's the sense of, you know, they really just kind of shattered the boundaries of, you know, like being a band, you know, sort of like fornicating out on the road and drinking and doing everything excessive that they could. And I think that's a lot of what people look at when there's rock band urban legends. It's because the people want to hear stories about things they wouldn't be doing themselves, but they might want to. It's like, ah, there's bad behavior. You know, I can at least experience it vicariously.
Well, the old sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is about your book, it's not just about rock and roll urban legends. There's actual real things that actually happen that sort of like, you know, the classic bands trashing hotel rooms or doing this or that. You say, yeah, some of this actually did happen.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Was there one story which you, you know, got the question for your column and you said, there is no way that this could be true? And then it actually turned out, yeah, it actually did happen.
There were several, and but the one that sort of immediately comes to mind was I got a letter saying, is it true that Pink Floyd made an entire album using household objects? I thought, well, of course not. But, you know, I'm like, well, it's still an interesting question. So let me try to figure out, like, what this is. Maybe it was a different band that tried it. It turns out that, you know, Pink Floyd didn't actually make an album doing that, but they tried to. After Dark Side of the Moon they came out, they had sort of sold a gazillion copies. They didn't know what to do next. And they sort of started doing, like, these little science experiments in the studio where they'd sort of get like hammers and brooms and pieces of tape, and they were using them to try to like make musical sounds. And, you know, sort of after a couple of months, they realized, well, there's a reason people use musical instruments. It's much easier to go ahead and play music on them. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. So they dropped the project, but I think it sort of cleansed their palate where they were able to actually go ahead and make their next album.
Now, a lot of bands, they don't mind if urban legends and myth and lore are associated with them. You know, they, in fact, a lot of bands, I'm sure, encourage that. But has this ever backfired on someone? Has it ever ruined a career?
I don't think at this point that's possible. That, you know, you take a band like Marilyn Manson, where there's lots of stories attached, and before them, say, like Ozzy Osbourne, and some of the same stories, you know, sort of like they kill puppies, or and it just adds into it. Burnishes the myth of, you know, like this person is actually the Antichrist Booga Booga. But there's definitely people who thought like Scandal were going to destroy their career. When the Madonna nude photos came out in the early 80s, you know, sort of obviously things worked out for her. But I remember she genuinely thought at the time, you know, this could be a huge thing that sort of like knocks the legs out from under my career. The Kinks weren't able to tour the United States for 4 or 5 years in the 60s. And it's not, I sort of go into this in the book, and it's not 100% clear exactly what it was, whether they were blacklisted because they hadn't paid their dues in a union or because they had gotten in an argument with somebody powerful. But at the time when the band was at its peak, you know, sort of they weren't able to go what could have been one of their biggest markets. And, yeah, so they never really got big in the United States until the 70s.
So why do you think this group of people, rock stars,
yes,
why do you think this group is so well-suited for these types of stories?
I often like talk about people as being good rock stars. Like, there's plenty of musicians I like who just sort of, you know, like are actually kind of sort of quiet and retired. Like Van Morrison makes great albums, but he's not a particularly great rock star. You know, he's sort of just kind of like grumpy and hangs around. Courtney Love, you know, has made good music at various points, but is much more sort of uneven and probably less talented. But she's a great rock star. You know, she's outrageous. You know, she does excessive things in public. You know, she's always like a good, reliable bit of scandal. So, you know, there's the sort of people who are leave scandal in their wake everywhere they go. Sort of they're attracted to the notion of like getting on stage in front of a lot of people and being the center of attention. So it all kind of perpetuates itself. And if they're good at that, and if people enjoy what that keeps on going, and they'll get more successful, and one thing leads to another.
So would you call them modern day folk heroes?
Modern day Greek god archetypes, maybe. In some cases it's Apollo, and in some cases it's Dionysus. But it's sort of people that we can attach stories to, who are sort of like going across the land, leaving a wake of either sort of music or destruction or hangovers behind them.
So how did the column that this book is based on, that you did for Rolling Stone, how did the column come about? And in the course of doing the column, what was the strangest thing that someone asked you?
The column came about just because I got asked a lot of these questions at parties. And the more I thought about it, the more I said, if my friends are asking me to like vet this stuff and see what's real and what's not, surely, other people would be interested in hearing the answers. And so I started off with just kind of a handful of questions from friends, but it seemed like interesting stuff. It was, what kind of grades did Mick Jagger get at the London School of Economics? And it was one of the very first questions was the title of the book, Is Tiny Dancer Really Elton's Little John? Somebody said, who's the guy singing to in Tiny Dancer? I always thought it was some kind of woman muse, but my friend insists, he's singing to his private parts, Tiny Dancer in My Hand. And I said, how do you find out? Well, the guy who wrote the song is Bernie Taupin. He wrote the lyrics. Let me see if I can get him on the phone. And I could. And I asked him, I said, hey, here's this theory. And he laughed and said, no, I would never belittle myself. So just doing the first couple, I said, this works. I'm finding out, even though I've immersed myself in music for decades now, I'm finding out things that I didn't know. And so if it's interesting to me, it's going to be interesting to other people.
So what was the strangest thing that someone ever asked you?
The strangest thing? There were definitely things that, sort of surprised me. I was always interested in, people would know really lurid specific rumors, they would have heard that Frank Zappa got drafted because he was a pornographer, and just trying to sort of go back and vet some of those things. Did the Allman Brothers have a foot shooting party so Greg wouldn't have to go to Vietnam? So there's just these juicy little byways of rock and roll that turn out to the actual stories.
So, I mean, they're true?
Many of them. Greg did, in fact, shoot his foot, they called the ambulance first, and when they heard the sirens, pulled the trigger and went into the induction center on crutches the next day and didn't have to serve. Frank Zappa was not drafted because of being a pornographer, but he got he served time because he made a porn audio tape and what turned out to be a sting operation by the local sheriff's department, spent about a month in jail, and as a result was a convicted felon and so couldn't be drafted.
So are you working on a sequel?
Kicking it around. There's always crazy things happening, and they still get questions. So enjoying this one for a little while, but maybe next year, start thinking about putting another one together.
Well, is there a question that has been on your mind recently that you've been looking into?
I was about to start telling you a story that the FCC would have problems with. People wanting to know about how Graham Parsons died, out in the California desert, and there's a lot of myths that go into it, what did they have to do to get him to recover? And, was he wearing a Neil Young t-shirt when he was cremated? And what exactly happened to the body afterwards? And, it got stolen and brought out. So there's a lot of conflicting stories there. And if I do another book, it's something I think I would try to pull apart a little bit and find out what actually happened.
And if people have their own rock questions for you, is there a place they can send them?
Absolutely. I've got an email address. It is askmrrock @gmail.com.
That's Gavin Edwards, author of Is Tiny Dancer Really Elton's Little John? Music's Most Enduring Mysteries, Myths, and Rumors Revealed. It's published by Three Rivers Press. This is Sidetrack. It's been more than 5 years since singer-songwriter Jay Bennett's well-publicized departure from the band Wilco. Bennett says the end of that collaboration and a number of personal tragedies all played a part in his latest CD. The Magnificent Defeat is Bennett's fourth album since leaving Wilco and includes a small portion of nearly 70 songs he's written in the past few years. AM580's Jeff Bosser talked with Jay Bennett, a University of Illinois graduate, about his latest work and how a collaboration on campus jump-started his musical career.
Always help you get along. I just can't fall for right or wrong, but I still wanna thank you.
This has been a hard couple of years for you, but you also mentioned at the same time you didn't have a deadline to meet. And what did the lack of demands mean for you, and as far as being able to produce the album you wanted?
Well, I guess it meant a couple of things. One, it meant I didn't make any money because I pretty much locked everybody out of my studio except myself and my partner David. You know, I've recently gotten rid of it for about 3 years. I had my own studio in Chicago, and I just kind of gradually decided that, you know, I guess that the only way I was going to heal myself from all of these things that were going on, I mean, I guess distract/heal, was to dive into what I do to try to get some catharsis, really. At the same time, I don't think I was writing specifically about what was going on in my life. You know, curiously enough, as I look back on it, I see that I kind of was, because this is the first record I've put the lyrics in the liner notes. And as I go back and read the lyrics, which I had to, you know, like proofread 15 times, I realize, and I'm not one who's big on reading lyrics outside of the context of listening to the song, but at the time, I just wanted to get active. And so I really just kept writing songs up until the point where it really became almost cumbersome and not really having an outlet that I was happy with to get them out.
Well, with all these songs now, are you itching to release this CD and, you know, record a few more of them, or have a few more of them released on something to follow it up?
Well, yeah. I'm you know, the way I work is I don't really make demos and then go back and recut them as the record. The demos, much in the way Wilco worked, actually, you know, the demos just always morphed into the record. But yeah, I'm already kind of itching. I still have a big pool of songs sitting around. But at the same time, I don't want to rely on that pool of songs for, what, you know, 3-4 years. But it's nice to know I have it if I kind of have a slump.
Did you forget to mention you forgot your best intentions, and all at once you're so alarmed? The wake-up call has finally gotten through to you. But there's no one to mention, too much time. let me add you to the list of coulda beens. You could have been the one. Open up your heart again.
I wanted to talk about probably the last album, I guess, that you were involved in that had the greatest amount of scrutiny attached to it with Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, and probably had a considerable amount of time of post-work in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, we spent a hell of a long time on that record. And in particular, the way I always describe the process of us making that record was we really constructed, deconstructed, reconstructed, deconstructed, double reconstructed, really every song on the record, you know. We'd try the basic track three or four different ways. Once we got the way that we thought was right, we'd do a bunch of overdubs, then we'd kind of, sometimes we'd tear away the basic track and substitute a different backing track under it, and yeah, there's a lot of, you know, reconstruction, deconstruction on that record that was really fun and really cool. Just, I mean, and again, we were kind of working in that same world that I was working on this record of, you know, really nobody was putting any pressure on us, you know, even when we were still with the label, you know, no one was breathing down our necks, you know, and it was the same thing. It was my studio set up at what was then the Wilco Loft, and same kind of deal, you know. And if someone came in with a new song, even if we had enough songs, we'd go ahead and give it a try, you know. So there's a lot of tunes on the cutting room floor from that record too, you know. Just the way I prefer to work, actually.
When you said you'd stand by me through rich and poor, good and bad times, did you mean that was forever? Or was it just a promise to a God you don't believe in? Playing out our lives measure by measure. And I will not accept the shame I never promised not to change. I would never play your part, one you're begging to exchange. There was this girl in my fifth grade, she drew pretty pictures.
You listen back now to some of these tunes, like Fifth Grade, and say, you know, of course that was about my personal life.
The third verse is very much about my divorce. You know, it's plain as day to me that it is, in particular. If you're trying to make it, you know, as positive of an experience as it can be going through divorce, you know, one of the things you do is look for patterns in, well, how other relationships in your life have fallen apart. And I think it's real clear to me that that's what I'm exploring on the choruses of that song. Is, you know, what's gotten screwed up, you know, consistently? What, you know, what are the consistent elements of every relationship I've ever had that's fallen apart? And so, yeah, that was, you know, and those lyrics came to me like a flash, you know. I mean, typically I write my music and lyrics right there on the spot, and, you know, typically even the vocal I do, as the lyrics are coming out, ends up being the keeper vocal, like it is on that song. But yeah, so I can't. There's this weird sense in which I mean, everybody, every songwriter in the world has said it, but it probably merits being said one more time. You know, John Lennon always said, you know, he didn't write songs; he picked them out of the air. You know, and that's definitely how I feel when I'm writing a song. Like, I pick those lyrics out of the air, and, you know, now as I look back, I see what they're about.
Edward Birch is still a part of this album as well.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that collaboration, and since we're on the subject of Mr. Birch, how you guys started performing together and, you know, met here on the campus.
Well, I guess we just met during those kind of obligatory years, or at least they're obligatory for just about everybody I know that doesn't dive right into their trade after they've finished college. I think it would be apt to say that Edward and I were both flunking out of grad school when we met, and therefore had spent a little too much time just goofing around and singing and writing and playing on the porch when we should have been doing schoolwork. So I think our collaboration probably led to us both being politely asked to leave graduate school.
But you did teach math at Urbana Junior High.
I did. I did take 1 year between undergraduate and graduate, and I taught junior high math. At the time, it was Urbana Junior High, and now it's Urbana Middle School.
What else do you take with you from your years at the U of I and I guess coming into your own or discovering you wanted to be a musician?
Well, you know, I think I spent a lot of time not really knowing if music was going to be a profession or a hobby for me. And some of that had to do with outside influence, you know, like the woman I did my student teaching with saying, God, you're such a great teacher. I really hope that you can do the music as a hobby. And then, you know, some other people in my life telling me the same thing. And then a lot of it was internal as well, just knowing that music's a pretty, you know, an iffy thing to call your profession, because it can kind of fall apart at any moment, really, you know, as it nearly has for me a couple of times, you know. But I think it was when I met Ken Hartz from Titanic Love Affair. You know, he was kind of the first person I met who I could consider, he was really my first kind of, first really satisfactory and satisfying and rewarding co-writer. And we really clicked writing songs together. And once I felt what that felt like, to write together and both be really satisfied with the product, and then, of course, being able to record it as well, and then the band going on to be, you know, being at least for a time relatively successful, you know, Titanic Love Affair, I owe a lot to Ken because we really clicked, and it was the first time I really felt like I was writing songs that were really up to par, you know, and a lot of that had to do with him. We just really clicked. We wrote together really well, and that was the kind of thing that kind of pushed me over into thinking, well, if I can keep working with this guy, you know, I'm going to make the commitment, you know.
And that you guys released how many albums?
Well, like an album, an EP, and then another album.
Okay. Well, obviously, while you're leaving Wilco didn't happen the way you wanted it to, but what did that separation with Jeff Tweedy and the rest of the band, what kind of positives do you think came from that in terms of maybe being able to express yourself in any of the recent albums?
I have to tell you, I think it was almost instantaneously positive. You know, I think I dwelled on it for about 2 days, and then I called up Edward and said, hey, do you want to make a record? And the next morning, Edward was down in my basement, you know, and we had carted off all the gear from the Wilco studio and hauled it into my basement together, and we were making a record. However I left Wilco doesn't really matter to me, because it was the right thing to happen. And I very, very quickly was completely convinced that was kind of the kick in the pants I needed to get going, you know, to enable me to do what I really wanted to do. And you know, because every time Wilco took off tour, I would start a record, you know, either a solo record or a record with Edward, and then I'd get 5 or 6 songs into it, and then Wilco would either go into the studio or go out on tour. And so I just had all these kind of half albums laying around, and, you know, finally I could, you know, have the time and the resources, and it was really good to have Edward there on that first record, because I didn't have to go from band to solo, you know, it was a transitional kind of thing.
What are you most proud of from being part of that band? Was it Yankee Hotel or maybe something from Summer Teeth?
Oh, yeah, I have to tell you, I am proud of all the work we did together, honestly, you know. The 3 records, you know, I mean, I think there's kind of emotional high points, you know, just being involved on the, you know, being invited and then actually getting to write songs with Woody Guthrie, you know, the Mermaid Avenue records. I mean, that's an emotional high point for sure. I think that Mermaid Avenue 1 was just an incredible experience to be able to go to the Woody Guthrie archives and Nora Guthrie saying, "You have permission to write the music to this song, you and you alone, you know?" And in particular, getting to write the song California Stars with Woody was just, I mean, when I grew up, the music I remember being played in my house as a child was a lot of Burt Bacharach and a lot of Woody Guthrie. And here I am, you know, decades later, writing songs with Woody Guthrie.
I like to rest my heavy head tonight on the bed. The California stars, I like to lay my weary bones tonight on the bed. The California stars, I love to feel your hand touching mine. Tell me why I must keep working on. Yes, I'll give my life.
Something like Slow Beautifully Seconds Faster. I mean, you're not going to be able to reproduce that on stage.
Exactly.
And
you're absolutely correct.
And so there's work here that, you know, you've got to alter your plan when you're going to do a live show.
Yeah. And, you know, and that, again, it started to happen there with Wilco, you know, even on Summer Teeth, where we knew we weren't going to be able to reproduce things live. So you just kind of try to get at the guts of the song, you know. What are the real core elements that need to be there to get across the emotional content of the song, even if you're not getting across the exact musical content of the song? You know, what musical elements need to be there to convey the emotional content? You know, and I've always claimed that if a song's a great song, it really should work with just acoustic guitar and vocal. And I very consciously chose songs on this record, with the possible exception of that first one, Slow Beautifully, Seconds Faster, that really, well, the reason I know they can work just acoustic guitar and vocal is that that's kind of how they were written. Yeah.
Oh, people always ask me why.
That was AM580's Jeff Bossert talking with singer-songwriter Jay Bennett. Bennett's latest CD is entitled The Magnificent Defeat. It's on Rykodisc Records. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.